Welcome to Keystrokes, a program about technology and accessibility. My name's Mike Haskins. For the next hour, I'll read from the Apple Viz website, Accessible Android, TimDixon.net, DoubleTap, the AP, the New York Times, and maybe some PC World magazine there at the end. But we'll start off this week with an article from Apple Viz. This is titled, A Guide to the New On-Device View Assistant for the Blind by Privacy AI. And this was written by Alienet. Privacy AI is a helpful tool for your iPhone, iPad, or Mac that uses artificial intelligence directly on your device. Most AI apps send your data to the cloud, but this one works completely offline. This keeps your conversations and photos private because they never leave your device. You can use it to write stories, translate different languages, and look at documents. The developer recently added a feature called View Assistant. This tool is free and uses your camera to continuously describe what is around you. It does not need an internet connection, and there are no monthly fees. The layout can be a bit tricky for voiceover users because it does not follow a standard, simple design. It takes a little patience to learn where everything is, but it is very useful once you understand it. This guide will walk you through the setup. The most important rule, the menu button. The menu button is your best friend in this app. There are a lot of features, and it's easy to get confused about which screen you are on. If you ever feel lost, find and double tap the menu button. This button always brings you back to the main list so you can start over. Step 1. Getting the vision model ready. The app comes with a few basic models already installed, but the View Assistant needs a specific vision model to work. You have to download this before you can use the camera features. 1. Open the app and tap the button that says Get Started. 2. Find the menu button and double tap it. 3. Look for the option called Local Models and select it. 4. Select the option labeled GGUF Models. 5. You will see a long list of choices. Swipe past the options for importing files or using Hugging Face. Keep swiping past the recommended models until you hear the section for Vision Models. 6. Look for a model named LFM2.5-VL-450M. Again, that's LFM2.5-VL-450M. This is a small and fast model made for describing things in real time. 7. Tap the Download Model button. You'll need to wait a few minutes for the download to finish. 8. When it is done, find the Back button and tap it to return to the previous screen. Step 2. Opening the View Assistant. Now that the model is on your device, you can find the View Assistant. 1. Double tap the Menu button again. 2. Select the option for Apps. 3. Find and select View Assistant. Step 3. Picking your settings. When you open the View Assistant, you will see a button at the top to start the environment reading, but you should check your settings first. Model selection. Use the model picker to make sure the LFM2.5 model you just downloaded is the one being used. Capture interval. This is how often the camera takes a new picture to describe. You can set it to 1, 3, 5, or 10 seconds. Choosing 1 second will give you updates more quickly. Prompt Edit Field. This is where you tell the AI how to talk to you. You can type a specific instruction like, "Tell me what you see in one short sentence." You can change this whenever you want to more or less detail. Enhanced Text Reading. There is a toggle for this. Turn it on if you want the AI to focus on reading a label or a page of text. Turn it off if you just want to know what a room looks like. Resolution Selection. This lets you choose the quality of the image. Higher quality gives more detail, but it might drain your battery faster. Step 4. Using the View Assistant. 1. Go back to the top of the screen and double-tap the button labeled Start Environment Reading. 2. Point the camera of your phone at whatever is around you. It uses the back camera by default, but you can also switch to the front camera if you want. 3. The AI will take a picture based on the time interval you picked and will automatically speak the description. 4. When you want to stop, find the button that says Stop Environment Reading and double tap it. 5. You can always use the menu button to go back to other parts of the app. How to change the voice. The app uses the standard voices built into your phone. If you want to change how the voice sounds or pick a different language, you have to go into your main phone settings. 1. Open the Settings app on your phone. 2. Go to the Accessibility section. 3. Tap on the option for Speak to Read. 4. Select voices to pick a new person or a different language for the AI to use. Helpful tips. Privacy AI is a very powerful app, and it is normal if the interface feels a bit overwhelming at first. Just remember that the menu button is always there to help you start over if you get stuck. The developer is working on making the app easier to navigate for VoiceOver users in the future. Using this tool gives you a way to understand the world around you while keeping your information completely private. And again, this article was written by Alienette. And at this time, I'm going to switch over to accessible Android. I've got an article here titled Samsung Galaxy Tab S11 Review. This is written by Salih Kunduz. I've been using the Samsung Galaxy Tab S11 for about 3 months now. Not as a secondary device, but as something that slowly found its place in my daily routine. Writing, browsing, managing files, testing apps, and sometimes just scrolling through content without thinking too much. This is not a device that impressed me on day one, but over time, it became something more. It became reliable. Design and daily use. Samsung didn't try to reinvent anything here, and honestly, I'm glad they didn't. The Tab S11 is thin, light enough for long sessions, and feels exactly like a device that's meant to be used every day. At 469 grams and just 5.5 millimeters thick, it's easy to hold and doesn't become tiring quickly. The aluminum frame and back give it a solid premium feel, and the IP68 rating adds a level of confidence you expect from a flagship tablet. That was one of the first things I liked about it, and it didn't change. I started using it almost entirely in landscape mode. On phones, portrait makes sense. On tablets, especially with a screen reader, that's not always the case. With the Tab S11, I noticed that both TalkBack and Jishu gestures feel much more consistent in landscape. Everything just aligns better. Gesture areas, navigation flow, even general orientation. At this point, going back to portrait feels unnecessary. That said, some apps are still not optimized for tablets. When you open them, they force the screen back into portrait mode. There is a workaround for this. If you go to Settings, Advanced Features, Labs, and Landscape View for Portrait Apps, you can force selected apps into landscape mode. Just keep in mind that not every app behaves correctly there. Layout issues can happen. Display experience. The 11-inch display is exactly what you expect from a high-end Samsung tablet. Smooth, responsive, and consistent. You don't really think about it after a while, and that's a good thing. For accessibility, this kind of stability matters more than raw specs. And the Tab S11 delivers that without drawing attention to itself. Performance, the real upgrade. This is where things become very clear, especially if you're coming from the Tab S9 FE. At first, I thought this would be a simple upgrade, but it really isn't. Moving from an Exynos 1380 with 6 GB RAM to a Dimensity 9400 Plus with 12 GB RAM changes the entire feel of the device. Everything is smoother, but more importantly, screen reader performance is noticeably better. TalkBack and Jishu feel much faster, more stable, and more predictable. There's less hesitation, fewer micro delays, and a much cleaner navigation flow. After a while, going back to the S9 FE feels slow. And that's not something I expected to say this clearly. Speakers, a real upgrade. One area where the Tab S11 clearly stands out is the speaker system. Compared to the Tab S9 FE, this is a massive upgrade. The Tab S11 comes with 4 speakers, and the sound quality is genuinely impressive. When you're holding the tablet in landscape, audio feels properly positioned. It's one of those details that makes media consumption feel right. Storage, connectivity, and real usage. The unit I've been using is the 128 GB, 12 GB version. And interestingly, after 3 months, I sometimes think I should have gone for the 5G variant. Not because I constantly need it, but because this tablet became something I rely on more than expected. I occasionally connect USB drives through OTG. I've also used my Rode USB microphone and my JBL Quantum 350 headset via its wireless receiver. These are not things I used to do on the S9 FE. And I think this comes down to one thing: how much the device invites you to use it. The S9 FE felt like a device that simply does its job. The Tab S11 feels like a device that pushes you to do more. On the storage side, I'm now seriously considering getting a micro SD card for this tablet. With storage prices going up, getting one now makes sense. But I don't want to pair a device like this with a basic slow card. If I'm going to use it seriously, the storage should match the device. Keyboard and workflow. A tablet without a keyboard is limited, especially for a blind user. With a physical keyboard, the Tab S11 becomes a completely different device. Over time, this tablet didn't just become something I use. It became part of how I work. I started using it as my main testing device instead of my Galaxy S25 Plus. That wasn't planned, it just happened naturally. Samsung has also added some flexibility on the keyboard side. There is now an AI key accessible with Command plus O, where you can choose your assistant. Some CMD shortcuts can also be reassigned, which gives you room to shape your workflow. If you're using Jishou, I strongly recommend trying the setup prepared by Ronan, a fellow accessible Android contributor. It genuinely makes daily usage much easier and takes your workflow to the next level. At some point, I even bought a 3-year Jishou license just for this tablet. That probably says enough. S Pen. Not essential, but fine. As a blind user, I don't rely on the S Pen. Some users are not happy with Samsung moving away from the Bluetooth-enabled S Pen, but for my use case, this change didn't really affect anything. I wasn't using those features anyway. That said, when scrolling through Instagram Reels or YouTube Shorts, using the pen actually feels good. Lightly touching and swiping between videos gives a more controlled and intentional feeling. Not essential, but still a nice detail. Fingerprint sensor. A real problem. This is one of the few areas where the Tab S11 feels like a downgrade compared to the S9 FE. The fingerprint sensor is now under the display. TalkBack does provide guidance, which helps, but in practice, locating the fingerprint area can still be difficult at first. Without tactile or vibration feedback, you rely on estimation until you get used to the position. But the bigger issue is not the placement. It's what happens after you set it up. Together with John Dyer, we discovered a serious problem. When fingerprint is enabled, multi-touch gestures and screen reader interactions don't always behave as expected. After restarting the device, everything works fine for a while since you unlock it with a pin. But once you lock the screen and unlock it again, the problem comes back. From that point on, gestures become unreliable and the experience starts to break down. At the moment, the only stable solution is to avoid using fingerprint entirely. Using PIN or face unlock keeps everything working as expected. I expect a fix with One UI 8.5. When that happens, I'll update this part. Software and updates. The Tab S11 ships with One UI 8 based on Android 16. When I first received the device in January, it was running the November 2025 security patch. Since then, the experience has remained stable. Samsung is also promising 7 major Android updates, which is a strong commitment. Battery life. The 8400 mAh battery holds up well in daily use. It easily gets through a full day, sometimes more depending on usage. And with 45-watt charging support, topping it up doesn't take long either. Better yet, it's predictable. You don't have to think about it. Final thoughts. The Samsung Galaxy Tab S11 is not a revolutionary device, but it is a meaningful upgrade, especially from the Tab S9 FE in my case. It improves performance, sound, and overall responsiveness in ways that directly affect daily use. And ultimately, it's a device that makes you want to use it. There's one thing I can't ignore. Even though the Tab S11 is currently Samsung's flagship tablet, the availability of cases and screen protectors is surprisingly limited. When you look at accessories for iPads, you can find cases in all kinds of styles, colors, and even designs tailored to different users. With the Tab S11, however, most cases look very similar, and the overall variety feels quite limited. Even websites that offer custom-designed cases for phones and tablets don't seem to have options for the Tab S11 yet, which I found a bit disappointing. And again, this article is written by Salih Kunduz. And you're listening to Keystrokes. My name is Mike Haskins, and at this time I'm going to switch over to timdixon.net. We've got an article here titled, Hands-Free Vision, Why New Apps on Meta Ray-Bans Change Everything. And this is written by Tim Dixon. I've been using Meta Ray-Ban apps as part of my daily routine for a while now, and until recently, they felt like a glimpse of what could be possible rather than something fully realized. They've been useful, but often in short bursts rather than something I rely on consistently throughout the day. That's starting to change, and it's happening quite quickly. The arrival of proper integrations is shifting Meta Ray-Ban apps from an interesting experiment into something far more practical. For me, this is the point where they begin to feel less like a gadget and more like a tool I can build into everyday routines without thinking about it too much. Be My Eyes and Meta Ray-Ban apps. One of the biggest steps forward has been how Be My Eyes works with Meta Ray-Ban apps. Being able to call a volunteer hands-free directly from the glasses changes the experience in a very real way. There is no need to reach for a phone, unlock it, open an app, and try to line up a camera. You just ask and the call happens. That reduction in friction makes a noticeable difference when you're out and about. It turns something that used to take effort into something you can do almost instinctively. Over time, that's what makes the feature stick. What's even more useful is the ability to contact trusted people. Instead of always relying on the wider volunteer network, I can call a family member when I need help. That might be checking a label in a shop or getting a second opinion on something more personal. It feels closer to how you'd ask for help in everyday life, rather than feeling like you're using a specialist tool. That distinction matters more than it sounds, because the more natural something feels, the more likely it is to become part of your routine. Era and Urion, expanding Meta Ray-Ban apps. And Urion is O-O-R-I-O-N. What's coming next is just as important as what's already here. Era and Urion are both expected to integrate with Meta Ray-Ban apps, and together they fill in some obvious gaps. Era brings professional, on-demand assistance. It's a different kind of support compared to Be My Eyes, and having that available hands-free removes a lot of the barriers to using it quickly. You don't need to think about positioning a phone or holding anything up. You just connect and carry on. That immediacy makes it far easier to use in real-world situations where timing matters. Ourion focuses more on object recognition and text detection. It helps you find things and understand your surroundings, which is already useful on a phone. Bringing that into Meta Ray-Ban apps makes it feel more continuous. Instead of stopping to scan something, you can keep moving and get the information as you need it. That shift from stopping to flowing is subtle but important. The apps I want next. I've recently been trying out an app called Curb to Car, and it's one of those ideas that immediately makes sense. If you've ever ordered an Uber and then stood there trying to work out which car is yours, you'll know how awkward that moment can be. Curb to Car identifies the vehicle and guides you towards it, removing that uncertainty. Right now, that's still a phone-based experience, but it highlights exactly where Meta Ray-Ban apps could go next. Being able to ask your glasses where your car is and get simple real-time guidance would remove another small but frustrating barrier. It's a simple use case, but one that shows how powerful this platform could become as more developers get involved. The constraint: battery life. There is one clear constraint that's going to become more noticeable as Meta Ray-Ban apps continue to evolve: battery life. The more these apps rely on the camera, whether that's for live video calls, object detection, or continuous scene understanding, the more power they consume. Even now, if you use the glasses heavily, you start to notice the limits before the end of the day. As more features arrive, that balance becomes more important. It doesn't make the glasses less useful, but it does influence how you use them. You start to think about when to rely on them and when to switch back to your phone. Over time, improvements in battery technology and power management will need to keep pace with the software. Otherwise, the experience risks becoming inconsistent. From gadget to something more useful. What's changing with Meta Ray-Ban apps isn't just the feature list. It's the direction of travel. Moving from isolated features to a growing ecosystem of apps is what makes this genuinely interesting. Be My Eyes, Era, and Ourion all solve different problems, but together they start to form something more complete. Add in ideas like Curb to Car, and you can begin to see how this becomes part of everyday life, rather than something you only use occasionally. For me, the biggest shift is that I'm thinking less about using the glasses and more about just getting on with things while they quietly support me in the background. That's usually a good sign that the technology is starting to get it right. And again, this article was written by Tim Dixon. And at this time, I'm going to switch over to the Associated Press. We've got an article here titled, AI Smart Glasses Will Help Visually Impaired Runners Take on the London Marathon. And this is written by Mustakim Hasnath. Running past Buckingham Palace during training, Tilly Dowler is closing in on a goal she once thought out of reach. Dowler has Stargardt disease and says she has about 10% useful vision, only began running last year, starting with a couch to 5K program before building up to marathon distance. She is now preparing to run the London Marathon with her boyfriend as her guide, using AI-powered Oakley Meta Vanguard smart glasses to help her navigate and track her progress. "They are AI-assisted," she said. "While running, I can ask for live cues such as what landmarks are around me and how far I've run." She said the glasses allow her to combine audio feedback with guidance from her running partner. "I can put my music on, but still be able to listen to my guide runner," she said. Her goal is not focused on speed. "My mission was to inspire other people with sight loss and people going through something really tough and inspire them to believe in themselves," she said. Dowler is among a growing number of visually impaired runners using AI-enabled smart glasses. These wearable devices combine standard consumer products with cameras, microphones, and open-ear speakers. They can be controlled with your voice, buttons, or some simple gestures, and use artificial intelligence to interpret surroundings and provide audio feedback. The most well-known smart glasses are from tech company Meta, which makes them in partnership with Ray-Ban and Oakley. More than 7 million pairs of Meta Ray-Bans were sold last year, underscoring their growing popularity. But they've also stirred privacy worries, including being used to film people without their knowledge, as well as concerns that Meta was sending the video to human reviewers for AI training. For Shah Khan, who lost around 90% of his vision in 2021 due to retinitis pigmentosa and Stargardt disease, the technology has become part of daily life as well as training. "It's like literally a part of me now," he said. "If I step out the front door, I wouldn't do that without my glasses on." Khan also relies on his guide dog, Moby, in his day-to-day life, using him for navigation outside of running. He said the hands-free nature of the glasses is especially useful because it allows him to stay focused on working with Moby without needing to handle a phone. Khan began running in 2022 after a volunteer from Guide Dogs UK, a charity that provides guide dogs and mobility support for people with vision loss, encouraged him to try it after his sudden loss of sight and the impact that it had on his mental health. While training with guide runners, he uses voice commands to interact with the glasses. "If they say, 'That's Big Ben ahead of us,' I can just say, 'Hey Meta, take a picture,'" he said. He said the hands-free nature of the device is important. "I don't need to be worrying about fumbling with a mobile phone," he said. Smart glasses use a front-facing camera to capture visual input and artificial intelligence to analyze it, converting the information into audio delivered through speakers built into the frame. Chris Lewis, a technology analyst who is visually impaired and has used smart glasses while skiing, said the system provides an additional layer of awareness. "The AI is taking the images coming in, analyzing it, and giving you the information about what's in front of you, what might be moving, and what might be changing," he said. He said this allows users to receive information in real time without losing awareness of their surroundings, which is important for activities such as running. However, Lewis said events like marathons can pose additional challenges, with large crowds putting pressure on mobile networks and potentially weakening signal, which in turn can affect how reliably the glasses deliver real-time information. Guide Dogs UK, which also provides other services to help people live independently, says the technology should be used alongside existing support systems rather than replacing them. These glasses can really support and enhance somebody's independence, but they're not there to be relied upon or replace core independent skills, said Tommy Dean, a technology specialist at the charity. He said guide dogs, mobility training, and human support remain essential, particularly in complex environments. Ben Hatton, an analyst at CCS Insight, who studies emerging consumer technologies, said reliability remains a key challenge. If you're going to allow visually impaired people to walk down the street or cross busy roads with the technology, then it has to be perfectly reliable every single time, he said. He said factors such as accuracy, connectivity, and cost will determine how widely the technology can be adopted. Despite those limitations, experts say advances in artificial intelligence are enabling mainstream devices to play a growing role in accessibility. The fact that consumer technology can enhance the experience of someone with a sight problem adds to the potential to be more and more independent, Lewis said. More than 59,000 runners are expected to take place in the London Marathon on Sunday, according to organizers, following a 26.2-mile route through the capital that starts in Greenwich and finishes near Buckingham Palace. And again, this article was written by Mustakim Hasnath. And you're listening to Keystrokes. My name is Mike Haskins, and at this time I'm going to switch over to the Double Tap website. Got an article here titled, PickyBot Expands to Smart Glasses as Meta Opens Platform to Third-Party Apps. And there's no one given credit for writing this piece. The developer behind the popular accessibility app PickyBot has confirmed that the service is now in beta testing for smart glasses. Speaking on the Double Tap podcast, Martine Vanderspeck revealed that PickyBot can now integrate with Meta's smart glasses, following the company's decision to open its platform to third-party apps. This development could provide blind and partially sighted users with live image and video descriptions directly through wearable devices. PickyBot, originally designed to provide detailed image descriptions, has evolved to handle video, PDFs, and multi-source media. Martine explained that smart glasses are now treated as another input device for the app, provided they include a microphone, camera, and speakers. The beta integration currently relies on Google's Gemini 2.5 Flash for live streaming descriptions, although users can still process recordings through PickyBot's standard multi-model system. The first reaction is always, "This is amazing," Martine said, but there are still delays of a few seconds, so it's not suitable for live navigation in traffic. He also noted that Meta's SDK remains in beta, limiting the functionality available to developers. While iOS devices currently offer smoother Meta integration, Android is better optimized for live AI processing, requiring developers to balance support across both platforms. Martine confirmed that PickyBot's live AI mode poses cost challenges, as continuous streaming consumes significant resources. He indicated that a credit-based or subscription model may be necessary for sustainable deployment once the smart glasses integration exits beta. Offline, on-device AI processing is also being explored to reduce server costs and improve privacy. This expansion could significantly enhance daily usability for blind and partially sighted users, enabling hands-free access to media descriptions in real time. With Meta's platform opening to third-party apps and wearable AI models improving, PickyBot's integration signals an important step toward more accessible, mainstream smart glasses. And again, no author's given credit for that piece. And at this time, I'm going to switch over to the New York Times. We've got an article here titled, "Struggling with Phone Addiction? Try These Remedies." Counting minutes is a poor way to curb phone habits. Real antidotes, experts say, include mindful parenting, curated content, and human connection. And this is written by Brian X. Chen. Nearly two decades after the arrival of smartphones, society is grappling with a problem that has grown worse over time. People love their phones so much that they can't put them down. Schools all over the globe, citing lower academic performance from digital distraction, are banning the devices from classrooms. Thousands of lawsuits have accused tech companies of designing phone apps to be addictive, including a recent case in California where a jury found Meta and Google to be liable for causing harm. Widespread concern over phone dependence has even helped start a dumb phone renaissance, with people choosing minimalist handsets to escape our app-obsessed, brain-rotting culture. And yet, as much as older adults complain that today's youths are glued to screens, few recognize that they, too, are part of the problem. Parents trying to enforce screen time rules on their children often fail to abide by similar restrictions for themselves. Counting hours of screen time, it turns out, isn't a great solution anyway, and there are more useful steps. So, the scrolling continues. But enough about our problems. What are the solutions? I interviewed experts, including professors who offered research-backed techniques to curb problematic phone use. They suggested remedies such as coming up with a media consumption plan for the whole family and enforcing screen-free zones throughout the house. Here's what to know. Assess the problem. First, it's important to assess whether you or your child is simply a person who uses the phone a lot or a person with behavior that could be considered addictive. Jason Nagata, an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, drew a parallel to substance abuse. Plenty of people enjoy the occasional drink, but the behavior becomes problematic when it begins to impair their social lives, affect their relationships, or hurt their work. The same types of red flags can apply to phone use. If a person is spending most of his or her time scrolling through social media apps instead of making friends, that could be a sign of a phone problem. Or if your child's grades are slipping because he or she is scrolling through social media instead of studying, it may be time to consider intervening. Come up with a family media plan. As is often the case, household behavior starts with the adults in the room. One study, led by Dr. Nagata, found that higher media use among parents was linked to more problematic phone use in their adolescent children. And for younger people who appeared to be addicted to their phones, the health problems cascaded. They were more likely to show symptoms of depression, attention deficit disorder, suicidal behavior, and sleep disturbance. On the flip side, studies have also found that problematic phone use among younger people was significantly reduced when parents set limits on the family's phone use in certain situations, such as during bedtime and mealtime, Dr. Nagata said. Children slept better when phones were kept out of the bedroom, and they tended not to binge eat when the devices were kept out of the dining room. It's important that parents practice what they preach, Dr. Nagata said. If you make rules about phones at the dinner table, you have to follow the rules. So come up with a family media plan. This could be a dynamic plan that varies throughout the week. For instance, the rules could be more rigid on work days. No phones at the dining table on school days, but loosened on weekends to let teenagers make plans to go out with friends. Coming up with a robust family media plan is easier said than done, because adults typically struggle with balancing home life with the demands of the office. Dr. Nagata confessed that if he had to break his own rule and use his phone at the dinner table, he first communicated to his family that he was on call for work. Think less about time and more about content. For much of the smartphone era, people concerned about phone use focused on screen time, the hours spent on their devices, as a metric to determine if they were addicted. But academics now generally agree that screen time is a dated concept, because not all screen time is equal. A person could be spending lots of hours each day writing work-related messages or reading a book on the phone, tasks that are not problematic. Cal Newport, a computer science professor at Georgetown University, who has written several books on minimizing digital distraction, suggested thinking about digital content similar to the way we think about food. Social media apps like Instagram and TikTok, which involve endlessly scrolling through random short videos, could be considered junk food designed to be addictive. Cutting off those apps should be a priority over measuring minutes spent on the phone. It's okay to think of these as the Doritos or Oreos of digital content and just say, "I'm an adult. I don't need this stuff," Dr. Newport said. Parents can also consider this approach when coming up with phone rules for their children, Dr. Newport added. While the current consensus favors waiting until high school for teenagers to get their first phone, Dr. Newport suggests delaying social media access until the latter half of high school, when it is more developmentally appropriate, as children's brains mature to better regulate their emotions. Replace scrolling with a healthier activity. For people cutting down on phone use, the toughest part is figuring out what to do instead, especially when seemingly everyone around them is glued to screens. Jenny Odell, an Oakland, California artist who wrote How to Do Nothing, a book about resisting the attention economy, suggested activities that counteract the negative consequences from phone overuse, including social impairment. She recalled volunteering at a festival in February in Berkeley, California, where members of the community showed people how to repair items. One booth taught people how to sew, and a group of high school students stuck around for hours, learning different ways to work with their hands. I find there's this strange divide between Gen Z people who are so addicted to phones and people who are so purposeful, seeking out those other things, Ms. Odell said. I don't know what that's about, she added. Maybe it's the age they were given a phone. Again, this article was written by Brian X. Chen. And you're listening to Keystrokes. My name is Mike Haskins, and at this time I'm going to switch over to PC World. We've got an article here titled, Amazon Says It's a Tech Deal. Price trackers tell a different story. Price trackers like Keepa and Camel 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 expose fake discounts. Here's how to use them before you make your next tech purchase. And this is written by Mark Hockman. Welcome to Shopping Tech Deals in 2026, where we're facing a new kind of predicament thanks to hardware shortages. Consider shopping in a supermarket. A gallon of premium milk costs $6. It's on sale for $4.50. The grocer marks the price down, $1.50 off, and tells you what you'd normally spend, how much the discount is, and what the actual sale price is. It's all very clear. Buying PC components in 2026 isn't like that at all, especially for hard-to-buy items like storage and memory. Suddenly, all of our assumptions are up in the air, compounded by confusing language whose relationship to reality grows more and more questionable. Look at the following Amazon listing for its Big Spring Sale on a WD SSD. Even though I already own a WD Black hard drive and SSD, my first instinct is to question whether this is a legitimate listing, given that it's unusual for the WD_Black branding to be spelled out. Second, is 57% off a good price? It looks like it at first glance. But that's compared to the list price, which Amazon defines as the suggested retail price of a new product as provided by a manufacturer, supplier, or seller, which you must hover over with the cursor to reveal, except for books. Amazon will display a list price if the product was purchased by customers on Amazon or offered by other retailers at or above the list price in at least the past 90 days. List prices may not necessarily reflect the product's prevailing market price. That definition means almost nothing. WD launched the SN7100 M.2 SSD in late 2024 and added the 4TB model in 2025, so this drive isn't new. Has it been purchased before on Amazon? I'd say so, which negates the need to try to understand if another retailer sold it at or above the list price, whatever that is. And if Amazon's list price doesn't reflect the prevailing market price, what does it reflect? It's all nonsense. And that's not even saying anything about what the new generation language tells or doesn't tell consumers. The problem is, we already know that both RAM and SSD prices skyrocketed upward at the end of 2025. But no one really knows what those prices actually are. Prices fluctuate, but we have no way of knowing if Amazon bought this SSD for about $300 12 months ago and priced it higher to take advantage of market forces, or whether WD sold it to Amazon at or near the $1,379 list price the company is charging. What's the price WD sold it for? What price did Amazon buy it for and when? What's the comparative price of the exact SSD at another retailer? How has this price fluctuated over time? The shopping tools you need right now. Fortunately, there are tools to help you track the actual price history of a product, and these tools are more valuable than ever. Camel, that's all one word, is one of them. At right, you'll see the price of this exact product tracked by Camel versus the same SSD tracked by Keepa, that's K-E-E-P-A. Keepa does a better job snapping up the exact price that Amazon is charging, though Camel gets close. The immediate takeaway is that Amazon's list price is basically BS. Yes, a competing site somewhere may have sold that SSD for $1,379, But Amazon, the site you're currently shopping on, never offered a price close to that, ever. The highest price of this M.2 SSD was, briefly, $739.32 on March 9th on Keepa, or $569.99 on January 6th, according to Camel. Elena Yee, who orchestrates some of our best holiday deals coverage, uses Slick Deals to monitor individual promotions and track prices. Keepa also offers a Chrome extension you can use to more easily track pricing information. I really like the way Microsoft Edge itself integrates price tracking, but you need to know where to look. Occasionally, you'll see a notification slide out from the URL bar informing you that Edge has found a better price elsewhere. In general, though, you have to hunt down the teeny tiny price tag icon at the top of the screen. Edge's price tracker wasn't designed to accommodate the sharp price jumps that take place in a short time, though. You can move your cursor over to follow the price of an item through its highs and lows, but you can't really zoom in to see the more recent price adjustments like the other services can. Still, it's a great historical comparison. Of the services I've mentioned, I like Keepa the best. The point, however, isn't that you need to settle on a particular price tracker, rather use them to do comparison shopping. PC Part Picker's Trends page can also offer a reality check for prices of generic components like RAM and SSDs. What it comes down to is this: the idea of sales is increasingly meaningless. Price trackers reveal how retailers raise prices a few weeks in advance, then discount those prices and claim they're offering you a deal. That's why, out of all the deals that retailers and manufacturers promote, our deals coverage involves poring over historical pricing and other trends. Recent examples point to the ludicrous nature of these retailers' tactics. Why not just say the real price of an SSD or RAM stick is $1,000 or $2,000 or more? And again, this article is written by Mark Hockman. And that's all the time we have for Keystrokes. Your reader has been Mike Haskins. Stay tuned for more programming on VoiceCore, your audio access to the world.